On this episode of Skeptico, Skeptical Inquirer magazine editor Ben Radford on the difference between skeptics and believers.
I like a good story as much as anybody. I like ghost stories. I like tall tales. But don't call them science. Don't call them reality if they're not. What I found is that the believers far more often ignore the skeptical answers than the skeptics ignore the believer.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on today's show, I have a very interesting interview with Ben Radford, managing editor of Skeptical Inquirer magazine. So the interview's almost an hour, and I'm going to jump right into it, but I wanted to let you know that at the end of the interview, I have a couple of comments, clarifications on some of the points that we talk about, so you may want to stay with us for that. Well, we're joined today by Ben Radford, who is the managing editor of Skeptical Inquirer magazine, you may know, or I'm sure you've heard of the magazine. He's also a columnist for LiveScience.com and the author of three books, hundreds of articles on science, investigating the paranormal, and other such topics. So, Ben, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show today.
Good to be on. Thanks.
You know, as I was researching, trying to get ready for the show, I was trying to gather some background bio information on you, and I didn't find much. So I thought it's a really natural way to start. Maybe tell us a little bit about your bio, maybe some things we don't know. And then what I think would be particularly interesting is maybe the events or series of events that led you to skepticism and being an advocate or having a passion for investigating paranormal claims from a skeptical perspective.
Yeah, well, I have a background in psychology from the University of New Mexico, and so that sort of in a lot of ways informs me in a lot of my investigations, because many of the claims that you encounter as an investigator, a lot of them boil down to personal experience, whether it's an eyewitness sighting on a lake monster or a ghost or what have you, or whether it's an experience that some people would consider to be psychic in terms of coincidences or precognition or whatever else. Ultimately, a lot of these boil down to psychology, and so that was a little bit of what launched me into doing what I do now. And basically, I got into skepticism, investigating these sorts of claims. Got into it when I was a boy. I would during many long hot summers here in New Mexico, I would go down to the local used bookstore, and I would dump down $5 in allowance, and I'd buy a bunch of used books. And many of them were these sort of books from the 50s by people like Frank Edwards, and there'd be books, Rupert Gould, Oddities and Stranger Than Fiction and these sorts of things.
Right.
And these are books that would have little short chapters about UFOs or monsters, and these are presumably true stories. I mean, these were not presented as fictional ghost stories. These were supposedly true accounts of, and it would say that on the cover. It would say, stunning, amazing, true accounts of, the weird and bizarre. And so I would read these, and I'd be getting into them. But then after a while, I'm thinking, well, hold on here. I'm only hearing one side of this. I'm only hearing half of the story, because these books would always present only the believer side. The only point of view presented was, ooh, this is a mystery, this is unexplained, isn't this weird? And I never heard anybody saying, yeah, but hold on, this was explained this way, or yeah, but what about this?
Right.
And so so that sort of, I started to think, well, hold on here, there's got to be another side of the story. And when I was in college, I had won an essay contest, and as part of the prize, I was shipped off to a small town in Utah to present a paper that I had written, and I happened to be there, and to be honest with you, I was looking for beer. I didn't realize it was a dry county, so it was not the smartest of moves. But in my search for beer in this dry county in Utah, I came across another used bookstore, And that's where I found an old copy of Skeptical Inquirer magazine, of which I'm now the managing editor. And on the cover was, it was a cover issue from, I think, March 1986 or something. And it was a piece by James Randi, the Amazing Randi, on Nostradamus.
Uh-huh.
And I read it and I said, wow, this is interesting. Here's somebody who is presenting a different point of view who's saying, look, you know, these quatrains that this, you know, this Frenchman wrote, you know, centuries ago, you know, not all of them are what they appear to be. And so it gave me a sort of more sort of scientific, skeptical point of view to it. And from there on, I basically just sort of got onto the magazine and started doing investigations on my own.
Fantastic. That is that's quite an interesting story, kind of a very organic, naturally grown skepticism that then winds you up at the magazine that you first encountered. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, actually, it was especially weird. I don't want to say coincidental, because that's freighted up all sorts of other implications. But I'd bought the magazine, and I had come back, and again, I was living here in Albuquerque at the time, and I showed my dad. I said, "Look, this is an interesting magazine." He said, "You know, I think the editor lives here in Albuquerque." And I said, "No." I said, "Yeah." So it turns out he was right. So the editor, Ken Frazier, was in fact here from Albuquerque. It was this sort of strange, you know, well, oddly enough, the editors, so I, you know, went up and met him since we lived in the same city, and it just sort of went from there.
Great. And so in terms of putting together the magazine, you're obviously there in Albuquerque, but it's probably like all enterprises now with online tools and stuff, you can kind of be anywhere and compile everything, huh?
Yeah, well, I had, you know, as managing editor, you know, I do everything from, you know, I do some copy editing and you know, arranging articles and this and that. And I lived in Buffalo, where the magazine's actually produced, for about 10 years.
Uh-huh.
And then I finally got tired of the weather and the economy and other things, and I moved back to the sunny Southwest. So many of the investigations I conducted were in Western New York area, and I've also done, also in Europe and stuff, but also here here in New Mexico since I've moved back.
Great, great. Well, I want to get into some of those investigations, because I think both the process as well as the product and the content that you've turned up are really interesting, and I want to dive into that a little bit more. But one of the things that, you know, I exchanged to you in an email and you got back to me right away on was this idea of dialogue, and I think we're both saying, hey, this is great. It's good that we're kind of coming at this from two opposite ends, but we are having this dialogue, because you just don't see very much of that, or the dialogue that you see is always so bomb throwing strained, you know, that it I think drives a lot of people to further polarize the issue. Well, why do you think there is such a problem having a dialogue between skeptics and believers, for lack of a better term, and why, more importantly, why so little collaboration on the research, on the investigations?
Let me just start by saying I think that's exactly right, and the lack of meeting of the minds has been a real subject of dismay for me for many years. I found that, you know, in my, you know, dozen or so years, you know, in skepticism investigation, that, you know, exactly as you said, more often than not, you have the believer speaking to the believer camp, you have the skeptic speaking to the skeptic camp. And rarely is there any sort of, you know, interaction. There's very rarely some, you know, challenges and discussions about it.
Right.
And I think that's very much to the detriment of the investigations. I mean, I've talked about this, you know, for example, a couple years back, I was giving a talk in Idaho at a Bigfoot convention, because that's one of my specialties.
Uh-huh.
And I said, look, you know, and I was, of course, the token skeptic. You know,
right.
Everybody on the panel were these hardcore, long-time Bigfoot believers. And I went in there and I said, look, you know, I'm willing to look at the evidence. I said, you know, I said, we have more in common than you think. And I said, look, you know, unlike the public out there, I take this seriously.
Right.
I take these investigations seriously. I spend my time, and in many cases, lots of, you know, money and energy, taking these things seriously, whether it's ghosts, Bigfoot, lake monsters, psychic powers, crop circles, take your pick. I don't dismiss them out of hand. I don't say they're impossible. I don't say they're ridiculous. I say, yeah, this is, this is interesting. Let's check this out. And so, you know, on that issue alone, we should have common ground because, you know, a lot of the public, they just think it's stupid out of hand. They don't even lake monsters, you know, psychics. Why would you? That's ridiculous. Why would you waste your time? And my answer is, if I were absolutely certain that these things didn't exist, I wouldn't waste my time. And I think that part of the problem is that there's a couple reasons why we don't have better dialogue. One of them is that a lot of people have their reputation stake on a particular position. And if you are if you're someone like Hans Holzer, who's a big ghost investigator, whatever else, it's more difficult for someone like that, who's written a bunch of books on ghosts and paranormal, to say, well, hold on here, maybe I was wrong about this. Maybe the skeptics have a point that these particular cases that I said were airtight, in fact, aren't. And there may be some of that on the skeptic side as well. But one of the real problems I find is that the believers, and you can take issue with that term. I don't particularly like that term, but just.
But what term? What term are we going to use? That's fine. I mean, I think we.
Let's just go with the believers. I mean, it's an imprecise and inaccurate term, but it's functional. So, but for the I've encountered this over and over and over again. The believers will very often ignore the skeptical literature. I've seen this over and over, whether it's, I'll give you an example. Just 2 weeks ago, I was in Barnes & Noble, and I noticed there was a recent article on lake monsters. And again, that's one of my topics of expertise. My last book was on lake monsters. Mm-hmm. And I picked it up, and I'm like, okay, this will be interesting. Again, because I'm very familiar with the topic and the individual cases and the individual monsters, I was looking to see what this writer had done about including the skeptical point of view. And this writer, who's actually a fairly well-known cryptozoologist by the name of Carl P. N. Schuker, who writes for 40 and Tams and other things, had entirely left out any of the research that I and other people have done on lake monsters. And it was amazing to me. I mean, this is, it's not an issue of pride for me. I don't care if he cites my work or someone else's work.
Right, right.
But at least be honest about it. Don't present cases about ghosts or psychics or lake monsters or what have you as if there has not been any legitimate, skeptical criticisms made about them. And I see this over and over and over again. And it's really frustrating because, I don't know whether it's just a lack of research or whether they don't care or if it is just fear-mongering where, mm-hmm. Maybe this case was disproved by a skeptical investigation 5 years ago. I don't care. I'm going to tell the woo-woo side of it and, no one's going to know the difference.
Right. Oh, boy, you brought up so many points that we could probably spend hours talking about, and maybe we'll spend an hour talking about them because they're really interesting. And I think that there's one thing is for sure, every point that you made cuts both ways. And I think, you acknowledge that almost while you were saying it. And I think that's, we have to acknowledge it, but it doesn't take away. It doesn't take away from anything that you've said because I'm sure that it's all true, that people who are entrenched and have a reputation invested in having a certain outcome are very reluctant to change their position on things. And number two, the ignoring the other person's evidence. I mean, that goes on all the time, but it goes on all the time both ways. And one of the things I think that's important to acknowledge, there is just this wide diversity of people coming at things from angles that aren't always the most sincere, aren't always the most knowledgeable, or aren't always the most credible. And that's why I think we wind up with all this different stuff where, like you're saying, a guy can come out and say, well, gosh, how can you ignore that? I don't know much about the monster thing, but I know, the deathbed confession of the Nessie thing where the guy goes, yeah, sure. I really, but it still gets shown. I have a a little bit of a sense for your frustration, because you'll still see documentaries and that picture is still used. And even if the words that overlay it say, well, there's some question now or whatever, why would we use this image if it's been discredited as a hoax?
Exactly. If you've done basic research or just you know, talk to experts. I mean, if they're legitimate experts, they will acknowledge, yes, you know, this image was discredited, proven to be a hoax or whatever else. But why would you not mention that? I mean, it's misleading to the viewers. And again, you know, part of the question is, what is the purpose? Is the purpose just to sort of entertain and,
right,
you know,
right,
put out a good story? Or is the purpose to try and find out what's really happening?
Right.
And my, you know, my position has always been, I like a good story as much as anybody. I like ghost stories. I like tall tales. But don't call them science. Don't call them reality if they're not. And that's one of my big beefs. And I would, let me just quickly, I have a little disagreement with you in terms of the ignoring the other side, because what I found is that, and again, acknowledging that I'm coming from the skeptical point of view, I make no bones about that. But what I found is that the believers far more often ignore the skeptical answers than the skeptics ignore the believer.
Well, you know, the problem with that claim, and you know, that may be true for you in the world that you live in, but it's all where you look. Because what I'd come back with, one of the biggest complaints I have with the skeptical community is that they often don't discriminate. You know, now I understand you're dealing with a lot of claims, and just anecdotally, what you're saying with there, you know, there's the credibility of the people that you just in passing were kind of talking about are all over the board. One of the things that frustrates me is that skeptics don't seem to discriminate very well between Uri Geller and Rupert Sheldrake and Dean Radin. You know, so I think people who are doing research, who've jumped through the hoops that we normally associate with being good researchers, publishing in peer-reviewed journals, all those other things, a lot of times skeptics just lump all those people in the same category as some charlatan who's on TV preaching some kind of Christian revival stuff with a pickup in his ear where he can be...
Right. I agree with that. Yeah, I mean, yeah, and that's exactly right. I mean, and that goes back to what I was saying before about you have to take these things on a case-by-case basis. And, you know, you're exactly right. I mean, not all people making the claims are the same. And there are people who have tried to, like, take, just for example, prayer studies. You know, there are people who have tried to bring some science to prayer studies and sort of say, okay, does intercessory prayer work, yes or no? And there have been scientific experiments done to address exactly that issue. So
right.
There are people who are bringing science to it, and I respect that, and that should be encouraged. And there, as you know, of course, as you were saying, there's also people who will just sort of make these wild claims about, well, of course prayer works.
Right.
And you're like, well, and you're saying this based on what? And it's like, well, you know, nothing. So I agree that those you know, there's a big lumping problem there, and I have, and you know, again, we had the same problem with skeptics where, you know, I remember one time a couple years back I got a phone call just from out of the blue at my desk, and some woman called me up and said, why are you skeptics always so nasty? And I'm like, I haven't even had my coffee yet. Who are you?
Right.
And she's like, well, you know, I you know, I was watching a TV show yesterday, and there was a skeptic on there, and you know, I don't remember who he was, but he just said that everything was bunk and this and that. And I said, hold on here. I said, I don't know who you're talking about. You're not talking about me. You're not talking about any of the legitimate skeptical investigators that I know. And so, you know, I mean, I hear this all the time. You know, the skeptics say, or it's
right,
like
right.
They say,
right.
Oh, who are they? Who's the mystical they people? You know, if individual skeptics make some, you know, debunking claim or counterclaim, whatever else, then do that. But I get this all the time where, you know, I'll read something that says, you know, skeptics dismiss, you know, all UFO sightings as mirages. What? Where did you get that? That's not true at all.
Right.
Or you know, skeptics dismiss this. Or, no. So that you know, the lumping problem goes both ways.
Well, it does, and you know, I have to tell you, you know, your background is kind of interesting, and in a strange way, it kind of mirrors mine in that when I got started looking into skeptical claims, I think I was coming at this from the standpoint of, wow, I'm hearing these claims of people who are claiming psi, claiming parapsychology claims. And I'm saying there has to be another side of it, and then digging into the skeptical claims. And I have to tell you, I kind of found the opposite of what you found when I really dug into. And what I decided to do is, one, I decided only to look at what I thought were probably the best paranormal claims. You know, I think Rupert Sheldrick, Dean Radin, Gary Schwartz, people who at the very least have very credible academic credentials, have published in peer-reviewed journals, and pass the basic requirements of what we'd say are probably good researchers that aren't making, you know, the real obvious mistakes.
Well, yeah, but you need to be careful, though, because, you know, while the people that you just mentioned, you know, in general, I respect them far more than I do just some, you know, someone claiming psychic stuff down on the street. But when you're talking about them publishing in peer-reviewed journals, that's true, but that's not necessarily, they're not necessarily publishing in that area of expertise. I mean, you know, Gary Schwartz, to the best of my knowledge, has never published anything on psi in a, you know, in a reputable peer-reviewed journal.
Well, he has, but hold on, because if we get into that, we're going to miss some of the bigger points that I want to make. I think he has, and I think I can show you that. But here's the real point, is that in that grouping, lumping that we're talking about, there's some basic criteria that we can say, and we can pick on people and, you know, what journals do they publish in, and which I think is usually a game that's played incorrectly by skeptics who are unaware of just how many thousands of journals there are and how serious some of these strange-sounding journals are. Take Rupert Sheldrick, and I had this discussion at length with somebody, and I said, well, he published in Anthrozoas, and they go, Anthrozoas, you know, no. Well, it turns out Anthrozoas is a very highly respected journal with all the right people on the editorial board and all that. It's just, who knows about these obscure journals unless you're in animal behavior research? So
yeah, but like, for example, the JSE is not necessarily. I mean, you know,
the Journal for Scientific Exploration. Sure,
yeah.
I mean, I think although I think there's a peer review process. It's not the same peer review process that is in place with a lot of other journals. But the point I think I was trying to make is that, as a first level cut of what folks we can trust, I think we can look at people's academic background, their credentials in terms of having a PhD, teaching at an accredited university. It doesn't automatically mean that we can accept everything that person says, but it does mean we should give them the benefit of the doubt to a certain extent when we look at their data.
Yeah.
But the real point...
I would agree with that.
Okay, and the real point I was going to make is, I mean, like the one bit of research that I've dug into more than anything else, but it doesn't relate as much to this show we're talking about, was the work of Rupert Sheldrick and then Richard Wiseman. And I'm just... what springs to mind when you say that, you know, here's Richard Wiseman, and I don't want to dissect that whole case in this...
It's pretty complicated and involved.
And it really isn't when you really break it down. But I will say this, and this is just, I don't think this is even at question or controversial. Richard Wiseman is still showing videos of this psychic dog experiment that are completely inaccurate, that were shown on TV that shows a dog going over to the window, and he represents it as a false reading of the owner coming home. And in fact, it's a cut and paste of a real actual event when the dog was doing what they were supposed to do. But the point is, you know, here's the same kind of thing we're talking about in reverse, where a skeptic is making a claim, the claim has been refuted, it's been beaten down, and yet it's still out there and it's still being kind of rehashed. And that's true overall with Wiseman's claim. I mean, Wiseman on my broadcast has now admitted that his data matches Sheldrick's. Yet when you hear any skeptic talk about And there's any, of course, there's exceptions. But if you're any skeptic, talk about telepathy and Rupert Sheldrake, they'll still cite Richard Wiseman's debunking as somehow proof that it didn't happen. So just more evidence that this stuff kind of cuts both ways, and these blind spots that we have are on both sides, you know, and the desire to preserve your reputation, it just happens on both sides.
You know, I don't know. I can't speak to what Richard is or isn't making claims about in terms of, you know, cutting and pasting jobs. I mean, I don't, you know, I'm not familiar with that, so I can't, you know, I can't say that that is or isn't true. And if Richard says that it is, then you know, I'm certainly happy to believe him. But I think the important part here is that we have people who are trying to bring science to it on both sides. You know, I mean, I don't think that, you know, not that you were characterizing it this way, but I don't think it's fair to sort of, you know, to suggest that, you know, Richard's criticisms of Sheldrake's experiments, at least in that particular animal telepathy case, were some sort of a hatchet job or something. I mean, I think he was, to the best of my knowledge, you know, Richard and his co-authors and others were making a sincere effort to try and understand and you know, figure out what are the different alternative explanations other than what.
No, it was a hatchet job, but we don't. I'm not going to go. We'll leave it aside because it would take too long to get into it. And let's talk about more things that you've actually researched, because it's not fair to spring that whole thing on you.
All right. Well, let me give you another example. Then, you know, Gary Schwartz's afterlife experiments. You know, Gary Schwartz has published a couple books and studies that you know, in which he's claiming that there's strong evidence for communication with the afterlife. And Ray Hyman, who I'm sure you know, was a, you know, psychologist at the University of Oregon, an incredible statistician, went through and looked at Schwartz's claims, and he found serious methodological flaws in the analyses and the methodologies.
Do you recall what those flaws were?
Well, they were published in Skeptical Inquirer magazine about 5 years ago. I don't. They're not off the top of my head, but they were published. We had an article on Schwartz's claims, and then we actually had a you know, rebuttal criticism by Ray Hyman, and then we had Schwartz respond to that. So we had, right. You know, we had it going both ways. And again, I don't think that, you know, my belief is that these are sincere folks. I don't think that Gary Schwartz is, you know, I've met Gary Schwartz. I like him. He's a nice guy. I mean, we got along, but, you know, I don't think that he's trying to pull a fast one. I don't think he's trying to deceive anybody. I just think that some of, and by his own admission, I mean, there are many cases where they've said, yes, you know, this experiment, like all experiments, wasn't perfect. As you know, no scientific experiment is ever perfect. I mean, there are always ways it could be improved. Right. You could have tighter protocols. You could add, you know, another layer of blinding, what have you. And so, you know, I think in these cases that, you know, and same Ray Hyman. I mean, I don't think Ray Hyman got up in the morning and said, I'm going to try to destroy Gary Schwartz's work. He took a lot of time and effort to try and do a solid, valid analysis and you know, and give his critique on it. And the same thing, another case we did a couple years back was Natasha Demkina, the girl with X-ray eyes.
But hold on one second, because before we talk about Natasha, who I don't know anything about, let me talk about the Gary Schwartz, okay, which I know a little bit about, because number one, we're I don't know if you're aware of this, but we're replicating that experiment with the folks at the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. We're going to do an on-air podcast replication.
Which experiment? There's lots of
and
them.
We're, well, just the basic medium communication,
well, right,
experiment.
Schwartz did five or six different ones.
Right, and the last few that he did was with a woman named Julie Bischel, who I don't know if you're aware of. She's at the university. She was at the University of Arizona, and now she's gone off on her own. And you may be aware that at the end they had continued to improve the protocol and tighten the protocol. And at the end, they published in a peer-reviewed journal an experiment where they did a triple-blind protocol where basically no one knows what anyone is doing. The sitter doesn't know who the psychic is, and even the intermediary who's passing the information back and forth doesn't know either the psychic or the sitter. So I don't know if you've ever looked at that research, but it does address all the points that were made by Ray Hyman and others.
Actually, it doesn't, and I do know about the research. One of the problems, one of the issues it doesn't address is that in many of these cases, the verification of the information is provided by the sitter. That is, this is not information that's supposedly coming from the great beyond that is verified by a third-party person. Much of this is information where the medium will say, I'm getting information from, you know, your husband or your grandfather, whatever else, and the information is judged either accurate or inaccurate by the sitter, and there's an inherent problem right there that has not been addressed by Schwartz's experiments, because the basic problem with having the sitter verify the information is that it's subjective. I mean, if the person says, you know, the deceased person is saying there was a problem with his chest, and the sitter says, oh, you know, my Harry who died last year, he died of, you know, a pulmonary edema, and so therefore it's a hit. Well, hold on here. That's not a valid way to approach the topic.
One, I don't think you're quite right in that, and I think that they've had intermediaries who've analyzed the information. But moreover, you know, the way that they break down the information, physical description of the person that's coming through, cause of death, hobbies, and there's one other category. They go for very specific information. So they died of some kind of chest ailment, yeah, you can say it could have been several different chest ailments, but I think if you actually look at the data and the readings that come through, it's pretty darn specific. And if you think also on physical characteristics, you know, somebody says, I see a man and he was bald and with gray, you know, okay, that's somewhat general, but it also is specific to a certain degree that can be analyzed statistically in terms of whether it's accurate. So I don't know what you're saying, whether you throw all that out or how you do that, but I think it's possible to do an experiment that way. And I really think they've come pretty darn close to doing the best possible job
I don't think they've really addressed that. For example, what I would like to see in terms of, you know, suggestions for people doing this is if you're going to do that, see, part of the problem here is that those descriptions that you just gave, those can still be vague. Someone says, you know, the person that's coming through is a tall man with gray hair. Well, it turns out that when the person died, he was bald. But, you know, several years, but, he, you know, maybe he lost his hair in the years before his death. So that way, you know, the sitter can say, again, this gets back to the problem of having the sitter verify the information, because the sitter says, yes, he had gray hair, then that's a hit. That's good information. But the medium could also say he was bald, in which case the sitter would say, well, you know, he had gray hair, but then in his last years, you know, he was bald. So, you know, you can have a medium giving two contradictory pieces of information, both of which would be considered a hit by the sitter.
Well, it all comes down to how you score it, really. Because there's no way around that problem, no matter how you attempt to gather the information from the sitter beforehand. So there's problems there, but there's also, like I say, in the details of the reading, I think you can also see, if we're objective about it, that there's some way to get at the statistical significance of the reading.
Well, what I think we should do, I mean, for example, you know, again, part of the problem is that a lot of these descriptions are generic. So, you know, I see a tall man, this is whatever. Okay, tell you what. Use subjects who do not fit what most people would consider to be a normal profile. So, you know, so have a subject who maybe lost his legs in an accident during the war. And, you know, presumably no one would know this, and see if the medium says, yes, I'm the person that's coming through, he doesn't have any legs. Or, a birth defect or something that would be obvious that isn't just a tall man, you know, with glasses. I mean, come on. I mean, come on. I guess my point is there should be enough variation in the subjects such that that meaningful distinctions can be made. And if the person, if the person was a dwarf or the person, I don't know, but there are ways to do this where a generic description of, a tall man, with dark hair would not fit.
Well, I think, I'm going to have many more shows on that, including having some cold readings from some folks who claim that they can do a cold reading and get just as good results. I just don't think you've looked at the actual readings that they've received. And I interviewed Julie Bichel a couple times on the show, and I understand her methodology as she described it to me. And the other thing, of course, is they get names many times, which of course there's some names that are more common than others, but it's pretty easy to put a statistical significance on getting someone's name or even the letter of someone's name. And folks who are able to do that time and time again offer pretty compelling evidence that can't be easily explained away.
Well, I mean, part of my problem with the whole notion of mediumistic communication is that a lot of the stuff is so mundane. I mean, okay, let's just say, for example, that you do have a medium who can say, yes, I'm getting a message from the other side, and it's a person, and this is his name, and he loves you. Okay, well, what value is that? Why don't we see information coming out that neither the medium nor the sitter knows? And I haven't seen that.
But Ben, as far as the medium coming through and saying "I love you," that would never be scored on any of the experiments that Schwartz or Bichel did. It always had to be specific information. They never scored "I love you" or "you're feeling good."
But that's very typical. I mean, I've attended dozens or hundreds of psychic readings and seances and whatever else, and that sort of stuff is very typical. I have yet, and if you can point me to an example of this, I'd be happy to follow it up and write it down and say it I was wrong. But I have yet to find a case either in psi research generally or in Gary Schwartz's experiments specifically that have information that neither the medium nor the sitter knew. That is new information. Not something that the sitter retrofitted into something that the medium said.
I got some of that. So I'll get back to you on that. And we'll do that. I will follow up with that on you. And I'll ask Julie Bichel, and maybe we'll have a conference podcast.
I mean, just to give a quick example, why is it that, why is it that we don't have reports where, a daughter, a grown daughter whose parents died and they can't find the key to the safe deposit box where the deed to the house is. And the answer, the sitter sits down, the medium sits down, the medium says, the key you're looking for is behind the fourth step in your old house on the lake. And someone goes there and finds it. That's never happened.
Well, I think it has happened, but more importantly,
let me jump in and say something.
We're gonna follow up on that. I'm gonna follow up on that. I mean, I don't know the readings as well as Julie Bichel, but I'll get you that. But more importantly, the question that you ask is a really tricky question. And I think that so many times when I encounter skeptics who are really interested in the science or the research, like you obviously are, they quickly switch into this mode, which I think is a dangerous mode, and that is presupposing that we have some understanding of how these things operate when we don't. I mean, we can't really ask the question, well, why doesn't this come through? Why doesn't that come through? All we can ask is there any information coming
through? But you're already presupposing that, but hold on here. I mean, of course there's presuppositions here. I mean, that's what the experiment is about. I mean,
the experiment is about finding out whether there's a statistical significance to whether there's a phenomena at all, rather than questioning why the phenomena works the way that it does.
Well, right, but the point that I'm making is that Gary Schwartz and other Psi researchers, they have, just to develop a methodology for studying these things, they're making assumptions all over the place about.
No, they don't really have to. They're just making it. They're absolutely.
For example, they're making assumptions that the medium will contact the spirit of a dead person. That's the basic.
Well, they're asking. That's the question, right? So, but what I'm saying is, let's not get too far afield. All I'm saying is that I don't think you can jump 4 research questions ahead and say, why is the nature of the communication this way versus this way, before you've identified whether or not there's a phenomena at all occurring. So,
I agree.
But that's kind of what you do when you say, well, why doesn't anyone do this? Or you'll hear some people say, yeah, like you did, why don't they come through and just talk to me or something like this? And you'll talk to mediums and say, well, that's not the way it is. I'm getting images and all the rest of that. And you don't want to take that on face value either and say that just because some medium says that this is how they're getting the information, that's how all information is getting through. I think what these folks are doing, folks like Julie Bischel and Gary Schwartz, they're doing the very beginning, first stages of research in the way that you have to do them, asking the fundamental questions and examining whether or not there's a phenomena that's there. What seems to be a frustration on the part of them is that even when they come up with that first set of data, there's such this wave of resistance to ever get to those follow-on questions and really understand the nature of this working and which statistically works better, this kind of communication versus this kind of communication, how long the person has passed, all these other questions.
Well, that's true, and there is, I would absolutely agree with you that there is a resistance to that, but the resistance comes from the fact that many of these methodologies are flawed. Many of these studies have mistakes in them, and I'm not saying that all of them are, and some experiments are better than others, and if they're good scientists, if they're trying to do good science, then people like Schwartz and Radin and other people like that, they will acknowledge, say yes, the criticisms of this particular case are correct. This could be done better. This could be done in a different way.
Well, I'll tell you what, Ben, bone up on the Julie Bischel experiment that she did, the triple blind protocol, and I'll have you on with her and we'll talk through that, because I think her understanding of that and of the criticisms and how they've been addressed is very different from yours, and I think it'd be extremely interesting. And she's a very nice person to talk to. She's not an edgy person. She's just very down to earth, and I think it'd be a great opportunity for you guys to hash that out and for me to learn something.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of the problem is that skeptics are sort of bottom line folks, and it's like, all right, here's the bottom line. If this evidence is out there, if these things are real, then why aren't other things happening? For example, unsolved crimes is a perfect example. I mean, people claim that one common definition of a ghost is someone whose murder has been unavenged. Well, in America and in all over the world, there are literally, tens and hundreds of thousands of unsolved murders. Now, presumably, if all it takes to solve a crime is to contact the spirit of the dead person and say, who killed you, where is your body, what are the circumstances, that's all it takes.
But Ben, that's back to the last point. Well, you're about to say, you can't figure out. Well, I'm saying I'm a believer, okay? I'm going to hold on to that title. But I would not go so far as to say what you just said. I don't understand the nature of the spirit world and how it works and all the rest of that. I'm a believer to the extent that, and you just kind of waded into a subject that I did want to talk about today, and this whole idea of psychic detectives, because I've read many of your articles, and you're obviously a very talented writer, and you do a good job of summing up these cases, and nothing is, you're not flying off the handle in a really incendiary way, but I do feel like a lot of times you pick on cases that have failed and make the case that that somehow proves something. And to me, it's like you're trying to be the Better Business Bureau for psychics and say that some of these psychics are not as good as other ones, or some of them are outright fraud. Fine. But I was reading that, I was going, gosh, why hasn't he looked at the best cases? And let me give you an example. Here's someone who I've actually spoken with, a psychic I've spoken with. Nancy Orlean Weber is her name, and she was on the Psychic Detective Show. So I go to her website in preparation for this interview we're doing here, because I've seen your cases where you've said some of these psychics that appear on TV, they never solve any cases and all the rest of that. You go right to her website and you read her letters of reference from detectives, you know, detectives who've been in the New Jersey State Police for 25 years and say, yeah, I've worked on her with all these cases and she really helped. Yeah, I spoke with these other investigators who worked on murder cases with her. She did a really good job. She received a letter of commendation. I mean, there's like this total disconnect. Why do we really care that there's all these failures, or do we care that the phenomena does seem to happen at some times with some people to the extent that it's proven beyond a doubt to the very folks who are very skeptical to begin with? When you talk about a detective on the New Jersey Police, I mean, these are people who are, you're not easily going to go in and dupe with some tall story. Where's the investigation on the best cases?
Well, there's a couple answers to that. First of all, you know, in my investigation of psychic detectives, you know, or anything else for that matter, I mean, I cannot and will never prove that psychic powers don't exist. I cannot and will never prove that Bigfoot or, you know, ESP or whatever, that's not provable. All I can do is I can say, in these specific cases, we've looked into this, this is what's been found, and in these cases, you know, the evidence is right there, look for yourself, this is not true. And the fact that someone has a high profile, I mean, you know, you look at the case of, like, for example, Alison Dubois, who was not only one of the subjects for Gary Schwartz, but was also, of course, the basis for the TV show Medium. She claimed that she had actually solved cases for the Texas Rangers and the Glendale Police Department. And I called the Texas Rangers, and I called the Glendale Police Department, and they said that she hadn't done that. Now, there's some investigation right there. You know, you have a high-profile medium who's making claims that she solved cases. All it takes is a couple phone calls to find out that's not true. Now, you know, in terms of the best cases, part of the problem is that as a skeptic, is like people, what happens, and I get this all the time, people say, well, here's the best case, look into this. So I look into it, or Joe Nickel or someone else look into it, and we solve the case, and someone says, oh, well, okay, no, this is the best case over here. So, and the problem is there's always somebody new claiming that, no, okay, maybe explain those, but this is the best case. And it's a never-ending battle, because every time you explain something, there's always some other case, you know, somewhere else, some other psychic who claims this.
Okay, but I understand how that could be frustrating. But I do have to kind of call into question the basic methodology in terms of, you know, like you were calling the methodology of an investigation. I've just given you a specific case where I wouldn't rely on the media. If I was doing the investigation, I wouldn't start with the medium. I'd start with the police. I'd start with going through psychic detectives, and we can take the cases that Nancy Weber's been on.
Okay.
And take the police that have gone on the record and said, this person did help us in the investigation and found all this information that we couldn't have found any other way and came up with this stuff totally out of the blue, and ask them if there's any misrepresentation, which we know sometimes happens in the media, of what you said. To your knowledge?
But there's a problem there, though. The problem is that instead of doing investigating, you're taking another person's word for her claims. That's not investigation.
I'm saying as a starting point, you know,
I mean, well, for example, look, I've talked to police captains who believe in psychics and believe in psychic detectives. I mean, I've interviewed them. I know that they exist. There's a hidden assumption in what you're saying that all police and detectives, are, you know, hard-boiled, hardcore skeptics and would necessarily be able to verify or not verify a psychic's help.
But hold on, let me interject here.
Yeah,
all you have to do is watch that old show, Psychic Detectives, or take any of these cases that are documented here, and you'll find plenty of detectives who say, this is the story gets repeated so many times, it's like They're reading it off a script. Hey, I was completely skeptical. I never trusted these people. And then I got in this case and they found the body, they found the car, they found this, specific things. Now, to me, that's the place to start an investigation.
You're right, and I've done that. And that's
Tell me where you've done that. Tell me where you've done that, where you've started with someone who's...
The case of Charles Capel, a guy who went missing. If you do a Google search for my name, Benjamin Radford plus Charles Capel, C-H-A-R-L-E-S, Capel, C-A-P-E-L, if you do a Google search for those two terms, you'll find my investigation into the case of Charles Capel, who was an old man who wandered off, and there was a well-known psychic detective, I forget which one it was, probably Noreen Rainier, who said that she had solved the case. And when you go back and look at it, she didn't solve the case at all. It's just, part of the problem is...
But did the police say that she had solved the case?
No, she did.
And that was my point again. That was my point again. Why not start with a case where the police have said...
Well, no, but actually, in that particular case, the detective did say that, in fact. His name is Sergeant Squance, S-Q-U-A-N-C-E. And I interviewed Sergeant Squance, and I said, you're quoted in this article as saying that that this psychic helped in the investigation. And he said, yes. I said, what exactly do you mean by that? And he said, well, when we found the body, some of the stuff she said was right. It's like, whoa, hold on here. There's red flags all over the place. That is not helping in the investigation. Having, if that's the criterion for solving a case, if that's what this, and that's what this police detective said, I think it was a sergeant, that was the criterion that he was saying led him to think that she had helped solve the case. But I said, well, who found the body? Well, it was found by a passerby. So the psychic did not locate the body. All you need to do, if that's your criterion, then any psychic who says, well, the body will be found partially clothed somewhere near water is always right, because most bodies are found partially clothed and somewhere near water. So if that's your criterion, then sure, psychic detectives are always right. But if your criterion is, does the psychic provide specific information that leads people to the body, that leads people to the body, not afterwards is some parts of it are found, oh, there was a White House somewhere nearby, or, there was a rock nearby, whatever else. That's not psychic information.
Fair enough. But hold on, Ben, because we're going to have another follow-up on this one, too, because this psychic detective topic has been something that's always been of great interest to me, and I've never been motivated enough to devote a whole broadcast.
Okay, tell you what we'll do. Why don't we do this? You find the best case you can find. Just look through all the psychics you want, figure out which one, and pick the one case that you think is airtight, and give it to me, and I'll get back to you in a couple months, and we'll see what we find.
Fair enough. That's a challenge that I can live with.
Good enough.
Okay. And I tell you what, we've taken about an hour of your time here, and we're really going to try and cut it short. But we're going to talk again, because it's been a real pleasure to talk with you. I think it's been a great exchange, and I totally respect where you're coming from. And there's a lot of follow-on work we can do. So we're going to follow up with Julie Byshell, and we're going to talk some more about the psychic medium, both the demonstration that we're doing with the folks at the Skeptics Guide and the past work that's been done. And then we're going to do this psychic detective thing, too. I think it'll be really, really interesting to follow up with that.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. Now, I'm hoping, let's just set it out. If I'm wrong, and sure enough, this airtight best case you can find does show solid, good evidence for psychic powers, I'll be happy to admit that. And I would expect that if I can show serious flaws and errors, and mistaken assumptions and bad logic, etc., in the case, that you would say, yes, the best case that I found turns out not to be so good.
I will admit that publicly. If you want me to stand on a chair while I'm doing it and videotape myself, I'll do that too. Okay. Okay, great.
Fair enough.
Well, it was great talking to you, Ben. And anything else to add before we, anything coming up for you that we should be looking out for?
Let's see. I was recently on the episode of Monster Quest on the History Channel.
Oh, excellent.
For my investigation into Chupacabra. I have a couple. I have an article coming out in Fortean Times, the British magazine of mysterious things, where I investigated a haunted house in Jamaica. And if anyone's interested, they can check out my books and stuff on RadfordBooks.com.
Great. And don't you have some kind of board game? I was reading that looked kind of Is that still something you're doing?
Yeah. To be honest with you, that's been what's eaten up most of my time and energy over the last 6 months. I invented a board game called Playing Gods, and it's sort of like theological risk, where you know 2 to 5 players each play a different god, and they try to take over the world to their own religion and either kill off other gods' followers with locusts or plagues or natural disasters or convert them. So,
well, I saw the god characters on the website, the cartoons, and they look really well done, so I'm sure it's entertaining.
Yeah, it's fun.
Okay, well, thanks again, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Good enough. Bye.
Well, I wanted to thank Ben again for joining me today on Skeptico. I really did enjoy the interview, and I think we managed to find a lot of common ground, particularly in our desire to further investigate some of these claims and really get to the bottom of them, which is the goal of Skeptico, after all. The one point I did want to clarify a little bit, because I glossed over it in the interest of time during the interview, and that's this point about Richard Wiseman and his use of this video that isn't very accurate. A few months ago, when I was really in full swing investigating Dr. Wiseman's claims against Rupert Sheldrake, and I did a number of shows on that, I dug up this video that really, I think, speaks to some of the points that Ben and I were talking about. Now, this video has been used over and over again by Dr. Richard Wiseman in these talks he gives about the debunking that he did of the Dogs That Know experiment. And there's two really, really big problems with this video. The first is that the video portrays something that didn't happen. So the video shows the dog, JT, repeatedly going to the window, and the voiceover suggests that this is a false positive by the dog. That is, that the dog is sensing that the owner's coming home and the owner really isn't coming home. And there's two big problems with this. The first and most important is that the data inside the experiment doesn't support the claim that he's making, right? So Richard Wiseman has come on the Skeptico show and said now that his data matches Rupert Sheldrake's, which means that the dog really is somehow sensing that the owner is coming home. And if you remember correctly, the actual statistics on this are quite lopsided. I think in the case of Richard Wiseman, if my memory is correct, about 78% of the time, while the owner's coming home, the dog is correctly responding. So to suggest in this video that this shows this repeated pattern of the dog incorrectly sensing that the owner is coming home is a complete misrepresentation of the facts as he now understands them. But the second part of the problem with that particular video clip is that the video they're using isn't really of the dog misinterpreting the owner's coming home. So what they did is they sliced and diced a little bit of video where JT's going to the window and sensing that the owner's coming home. But they used a video of JT correctly sensing that the owner's coming home, and yet they use a voiceover that suggests that this is a case of the dog repeatedly going to the window when the owner isn't really coming home. And as kind of skeptical folklore goes, this gets repeated over and over and over again. You may recall that when James Randi was on the show, he repeated this folklore by saying that, "I've talked to Wiseman about that dog, and he said that the dog went to the window all the time." Well, again, look at the data. The data suggests otherwise, and Wiseman has now acknowledged that the data isn't the problem with the experiment. So that's one part of the problem. And you can excuse that away however you want. And of course, video and TV production has a lot of flaws to it, and people are interested in portraying a story rather than getting the real science correct. But here's the second problem, and I get this directly from Dr. Sheldrake when I spoke with him. Several years ago, Dr. Sheldrake pointed this out to Richard Wiseman and said, "Hey, you know what? You're using this video, and this video isn't really correct." And this is before Wiseman had admitted that his data matches. So his point was just that, look, you're using video of JT correctly sensing the owner coming home, and it's being portrayed as an incorrect false positive. And Wiseman said, "Oh, yeah, gee, I'm sorry. You know those TV producers, things together the wrong way. Sorry about that." But he's continued to use the video for years after that. Now, this is just the kind of skeptical blind spot that Ben and I were talking about. And Ben, of course, sees it on the side of believers, and I, of course, see it on the side of skeptics. But what I wanted to do here is make clear just how these little burrs in the saddle of believers fester and why they fester. Because there's cases like this that are just clearly outside the bounds of what should be done in good science and what should be done in good faith in terms of a coming together of skeptics and believers. And it doesn't always happen that way. So hopefully Ben and I can kind of transcend this and get to a point where there really is a true collaboration. There really is an open-mindedness on both sides. And I certainly hope we can get there. I hope we can get there with the Skeptics Guide folks if we're able to move forward with the Medium research. And I think we will. I did manage to get a very brief chat in with Dr. Novella, and we're kind of targeting September as a time for doing that work. So we're going to look forward to that. Okay, well, thanks for listening. If you need any information on our previous shows or would like to dig through the archives, please visit the Skeptico website. That's skeptiko.com. You can also find links to our forum, an email link where you can reach me, and a bunch of other interesting information there. That's going to do it for this show. Until next time, bye for now.